And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is April 15th. Normally, tax day. But not now. Tax day is actually July 15th, I think it is. April 15th is the 105th day of the year. And 260 days remain until December 31st. Now, there's been a lot of events happen on this date in history. In the year 769, Lateran Council condemned the Council of Hera and anathematized its iconoclastic rulings. In 1071, Bari, the last Byzantine possession in southern Italy, surrendered to Robert Guiscard. 1395, Timur defeats Tachmish of the Golden Horde at the Battle of the Terek River. The Golden Horde capital city, Sari, is razed to the ground, and Timur installs a puppet ruler on the throne. 1450, the Battle of Formigny. Toward the end of the Hundred Years' War, the French attack and nearly annihilate the English forces, ending English domination in northern France. 1632, the Battle of Rheims. Swedes under Gustavus Adolphus defeat the Holy Roman Empire during the Thirty Years' War. 1642, the Irish-Confederate Wars. A Confederate Irish militia is routed in the Battle of Kilrush when it attempts to halt the progress of a royalist army. 1715, the Pocataglio Massacre triggers the start of the Yamasee War in colonial South Carolina. 1736, foundation of the Kingdom of Corsica. 1738, Circe, an Italian opera by George Frederick Handel, receives its premier performance in London. 1755, Samuel Johnson's A Dictionary of the English Language is published in London. 1783, preliminary articles of peace ending the American Revolutionary War are ratified. 1817, Thomas Hopkins Gladeff and Laurent Cleric founded the American School for the Deaf, first American school for deaf students in Hartford, Connecticut. In 1861, President Abraham Lincoln calls for 75,000 volunteers to quell the insurrection that became the American Civil War. 1865, President Abraham Lincoln dies after being shot the previous evening by John Wilkes Booth. Vice President Andrew Johnson becomes president when Lincoln dies. In 1892, the General Electric Company is formed. 1896, closing ceremony, the games of the first Olympiad in Athens, Greece. 1900, Philippine-American War. Filipino guerrillas launch a surprise attack on U.S. infantry and begin a four-day siege of Cotabig in the Philippines. 1907, Triangle Fraternity is founded at the University of Illinois and Urbana-Champaign. 1912, the British passenger liner Titanic sinks in the North Atlantic at 2:20 in the morning, 2 hours and 40 minutes after hitting an iceberg. Only 710 out of the 2,227 passengers and crew on board survive. 1920, two security guards are murdered during a robbery in South Braintree in Massachusetts. Anarchist Sacco and Vanzetti would be convicted of and executed for the crime. Of course, there was a great deal of controversy. 1922, U.S. Senator John Kendrick of Wyoming introduces a resolution calling for an investigation of a secret land deal which leads to the discovery of the Teapot Dome scandal. 1923, insulin becomes generally available for use by people with diabetes. 1924, Rand McNally publishes its first road atlas. 1936, first day of the Arab Revolt in Mandatory Palestine. 1941, in the Belfast Blitz, 200 bombers of the German Luftwaffe attacked Belfast, killing more than 1,000 people. 1942, the George Cross is awarded to the island fortress of Malta by King George VI. 1945, Bergen-Belsen concentration camp is liberated. 1947, Jackie Robinson debuts for the Brooklyn Dodgers, breaking baseball's coloring line. 1952, first flight of the Boeing B-52 Stratofortress. 1955, McDonald's restaurant dates its founding to the opening of a franchise restaurant by Ray Kroc in Des Plaines, Illinois. 1960, Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Ella Baker leads a conference that results in the creation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, one of the principal organizations of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. 1969, the EC-121 shoot-down incident. North Korea shoots down a U.S. Navy aircraft over the Sea of Japan. All 31 on board the plane are killed. 1970, during the Cambodian Civil War, massacre of the Vietnamese minority results in 800 bodies flowing down the Mekong River into South Vietnam. 1986, the U.S. launches Operation El Dorado Canyon, its bombing raids against Libyan targets in response to a discotheque bombing in West Germany that killed two U.S. servicemen. 1989, Hillsboro disaster. A human crush occurs at Hillsboro Stadium, home of Sheffield Wednesday, in the FA Cup semifinal, resulting in the death of 96 Liverpool fans. 1989, upon Hu Yaobong's death, the Tiananmen Square protest of 1989 began in China. 1994, Marrakesh Agreement relating to a foundation of the World Trade Organization is adopted. 2013, two bombs explode near the finish line at the Boston Marathon in Boston, Massachusetts. Killed three people and injured 264 others. 2013, a wave of bombings across Iraq kills at least 75 people. 2014, in the worst massacre of the South Sudanese Civil War, 200 civilians are gunned down after seeking refuge in houses of worship as well as hospitals. And in 2019, the Cathedral of Notre Dame of Paris in France is seriously damaged by a large fire. April 15th has been a day to be reckoned with for a couple of centuries. And it's also been a day of the birthday of quite a number of well-known people. For example, in 68 B.C., Gaius Maecenas, Roman politician. 1282, Frederick IV, Duke of Lorraine. 1367, Henry IV of England. 1442, John Paston, an English noble. 1452, Leonardo da Vinci. 1469, Guru Nanak, the first Sikh guru. 1552, Pietro Cataldi, Italian mathematician and astronomer. I mean, the list just goes on and on. 1642, Suleiman II, Ottoman Sultan. 1646, Christian V of Denmark. 1684, Catherine I of Russia. Certainly, we're talking about a large number of very prominent people. In fact, I've got a list of almost 200 people born on this date. Deaths in 628, Seiko, Emperor of Japan. 943, Liu Bin, Emperor of Southern Han. That was in China, don't you know? 956, Lin Yanyu, Chinese court official in Munich. 1053, Godwin, Earl of Wessex. 100 important deaths. Now, in 1912, a number of prominent people died on the Titanic on this date. Thomas Andrews, the shipbuilder, John Jacob Astor IV, American colonel, businessman and author, Archibald Butt, American general, Jacques Futrelle, American journalist and author, Benjamin Guggenheim, American businessman. Henry Harris, American producer and manager. Wallace Hartley, English violinist and bandleader. James Paul Moody, English sixth officer. William McMaster Murdoch, Scottish first officer. Jack Phillips, English telegraphist. Edward Smith, English captain. William Thomas Stead, English journalist. Ida Strauss, German-American businesswoman. Isidore Strauss, German-American businessman and politician. John Thayer, American business and sportsman. And Henry Wilde, English chief officer. Now, holidays is an interesting category to apply to April 15th. How about Christian Feast Day? Abbo II of Metz, Father Damien, the Episcopal Church, Huna, Paternus of Avranches, and Eastern Orthodox liturgics. In North Korea, it's the Day of the Sun. It's also the earliest day on which Sexhauten can fall. April 21st is the latest. In Hawaii, it's Father Damien Day. In Liverpool, England, it's the Hillsborough Disaster Memorial. It's the Jackie Robinson Day in the U.S. One Boston Day in the U.S. Poya Boshak, Bengali New Year. Of course, it's normally tax day. It's also the Universal Day of Culture. And it's World Art Day. Well, it's always interesting to look at all the strange things that happen around the world on different dates. April 15th, of course, is a day that many people in this country dread because it is the day that taxes are due. Unless you get an extension. Of course, this year, because of the coronavirus, it's July 15th. Now, we were talking about the triads yesterday, the last time we were here. Now, the triads were created with the dream of controlling government. But it didn't work out, especially after the Sun's successor as leader of Sun's Kuomintang Party, Chiang Kai-shek, was a triad member. So, of course, under his administration, they had a great deal of leverage, so to speak. When the Chinese Republic began to collapse from infighting and pressures of Mao's communists, Chiang recruited triad support, but unfortunately, there was too much corruption among his own group. Mao's victory in 1949 drove Chiang Kai-shek and his followers to Formosa, which is now Taiwan. And triad leaders who chose to remain in mainland China were hunted down and executed. Now, a few escaped to Portuguese-controlled Macau or to Hong Kong, where the British government, even though they said the triads were illegal, they didn't enforce the laws. For the last half of the 20th century, Hong Kong represented a hub of triad activity. And it served as a nerve center for many of their global enterprises. They were involved in any type of criminal activity you could imagine. From drugs to human trafficking to whatever you may want to suggest. You know, the more the triads moved away from cultural and political objectives toward criminal activities, the more they refined their secret rituals, adding new complex ceremonies. The core of the initiation procedure remained rooted in historical aspects of the groups, including elaborate ceremonies that require up to 8 hours to complete. Among the rites initiates before him is the passing of the mountain of swords, in which they walk slowly with only threatening swords held just above their heads. Now, new triad members are taught secret handshakes and subtle signals, long a distinctive feature of the society. The way chopsticks are held or set down, a number of fingers used to grasp a goblet while drinking, communicate important signals among triad members. Certain phrases are used to signify information not to be shared with others. According to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who infiltrated and assessed triads more effectively than any other Western police force, bank clouds meant smoke opium. Black dog was the code for a gun. Now, an extended list of code words was published in a 1987 issue of the RCMP Gazette and several other journals, so it's unlikely the triads retain the same definitions today they had prior to that article. Now, initiation into the more potent triads can include the ceremonial decapitation of a live chicken. Blood from that still struggling bird is poured into a bowl and mixed with the blood of the initiate, followed by a goodly measure of wine, the concoction shared by everybody in attendance. And after the blood and wine mixture has been consumed, the bowl is broken to signify the fate of any members who might break faith with the triad. New triad members have to pledge that his allegiance to the group will surpass the loyalty he owes to his family and loved ones. A pledge involving 36 oaths extending back to the 17th century origins of the triads. The oaths are specific, demanding, and inflexible. In the first oath, the initiate vows he must treat parents and relatives as sworn brothers as his own kin. And I'll suffer death by five thunderbolts if I don't keep this oath. In oath number four, he swears, I'll always acknowledge my hung brothers when they identify themselves. If I ignore them, I'll be killed by a multitude of swords. And within many of the other oaths, the new member acknowledges he has to be loyal or be killed. Oath number 36, a reflection of the original triad objective, is common to all hung societies. After entering the hung gates, I'll be loyal and faithful, endeavor to overthrow Qing and restore Ming, and our common aim is to avenge our five ancestors. Now, that pledge is at least 100 years out of date, but it continues to be delivered as part of the organization's tradition, adding an element of mysticism to the act, always the desired component for a secret society. Titles granted to triad members extend the mysticism by connecting it to numerology, and all triad members are identified two ways. By a job description that explains in a tangential manner their responsibilities in the organization, and by a number. The leader of the society is called the Dragon Head, San Chu or Chu Chi, and is referred to as 489. These three digits add up to 21. The Chinese language characters for 21 are very similar to the characters representing Hung. In addition, 21 is also three, the three elements that make up the triad symbol, heaven, earth, and man. Multiplied by seven, a number revered as much in Chinese cultures and Western society. So in this manner, the number 489 manages to sum up the life cycle of the society. The organization's financial advisor, filling a role similar to the consigliere in Costa Nostra circles, is called the White Paper Fan. Pak Si Sin, or Pak Si Sin, and identified as 415. Enforcers trained in Kung Fu are called Red Poles, Hung Quan, with the numerical designation of 426. Other operatives include the Straw Sandal, Cho Hai, number 426, who handle communications, and the Fu Shan Chu, number 438, a deputy of sorts to the Dragon Head. The number 438 is also attached to the Incense Master, Huing Chu, in charge of rituals. The lowest rank in the triad, a soldier or Sei Kao Hai, is assigned number 49. While attempting to draw comparisons between the triads and the Italian Cosa Nostra, the differences between the two are substantial. The Cosa Nostra may be Italian at its core, but in the past it strategically partnered with any other ethnic group, particularly Jewish and Irish criminals. Triads, in contrast, remain defiantly Chinese in membership and culture. Unlike Italian-based criminals who make no distinction among the individuals and organizations they may target, Triads select only Chinese as their prime source of income. While some collusion between triads and both the Kosanostra and Japanese Yakuza have occurred, triads have retained the most independence and secrecy of the three secret criminal elements. Another key difference between triads and the mafia concerns structure and discipline. As anybody exposed to the Godfather movies or an episode of The Sopranos can attest, the Italian organized gangs are as rigidly structured and tightly controlled as any corporation. Now, mafia members have to receive approval from the authority level directly above before engaging in any money-making activity and agree to forfeit a portion of the profits to that same authority. Neglecting or defying this rule can lead to severe punishment. Triads are not nearly as rigid, though, and the concept of passing approval down the line to workers and passing profits back up the line to bosses is totally absent. There's one member of the Hong Kong notorious 14K triad described his arrangement to an Australian parliamentary crime investigator during an interrogation procedure. He said, "I wasn't required to pay any percentage of profits to the 14K leaders. Triads don't work that way. Triad members do favors for each other, provide introductions and assistance to each other, engage in criminal schemes with each other, but generally don't have the kind of strictly disciplined organizational structure other groups like the Italian Mafia have. For example," he said, "a triad member wouldn't necessarily be required to get permission from the dragon head of his triad to engage in a particular criminal job. On the other hand, on traditional Chinese holidays such as Chinese New Year, triad members traditionally give gifts to their big brothers or uncles who often are officers in the triads." So an argument can be made that triads practice greater finesse than mafia members, whose penchant for brutality is legendary. Now, triad enforcers may be just as direct, but they often couch their threats and subtle warnings before taking murderous actions. One Hong Kong businessman who chose to defy triad threats was sent the severed head of a dog, perhaps by enforcers impressed with the celebrated scene incorporating the severed head of a horse from The Godfather. Only when he failed to heed this threat was he stabbed to death several days later. Their restricted association makes the triads doubly difficult for law enforcement groups to penetrate. Chinese communities in North America are among the most insular of all ethnic groups, with justifiable suspicion from outsiders probing into their culture. As a result, reaching triad leaders involves penetrating two layers of defense: the general cultural barrier erected by all Chinese against foreigners and the secrecy veil erected by the triads themselves. Another complication for law enforcement officers has been the ability of the triads to compromise local police forces, especially in Hong Kong. For many years prior to the handover of Hong Kong to the mainland government in 1997, the Royal Hong Kong Police lacked any form of criminal intelligence system and appeared to play down the size and impact of triads in the colony. Only a detailed study in 1983 revealed the true extent of the secret groups. The report also disclosed an enormous level of corruption in the Royal Hong Kong Police, including long-term collusion between senior police officers and triad leaders with regard to drug trafficking. Many Royal Hong Kong police officers grew enormously wealthy through their triad connections, and according to RCMP sources, more than a few immigrated from the colony to Britain and Canada in advance of the communist takeover in 1997, bringing their riches with them and settling down as respectable, affluent businessmen. The arrival of mainland rule in July of 97 also sent triad members abroad to avoid the inevitable crackdown, but many observers familiar with the level of corruption under the communist regime expect the triads have since achieved their old levels of influence. There is one critical difference, though. Under British rule, the few triad leaders who were caught and convicted faced prison terms. If the Beijing government applies the same policy in Hong Kong it applies to the mainland, senior triad members can expect to be punished with a bullet in the back of the head. Now, the Hong Kong triads may now be Beijing's responsibility, but their influence extends literally around the world, although with varying degrees of impact. In Britain, the National Criminal Intelligence Service conducted a study of triad activities in that country under the unimaginative codename of Project Chopsticks. When a 1996 NCIS report noted that four triad societies were operating in Britain, it concluded that none was controlled from Hong Kong, and thus the groups were not part of an international criminal conspiracy. Victims of the triads, the study reported, were usually small businesses operated by Chinese immigrants who often avoided reporting crime to British authorities. And the study claimed that the triads did not play a significant role in the country's drug trafficking, contrary to situations in Australia, Canada, and the U.S. In 1988, an Australian government study estimated that 85 to 95% of all heroin entering the country was controlled by Chinese triads. 10 years later, though, a U.S. investigation indicated that triad dominance had been reduced by competition from Southeast Asian countries and their organizations, primarily Vietnam, Cambodia, Burma, or Myanmar, and the Philippines. During the 70s and 80s, most high-quality heroin entering North America originated in Turkey and was shipped to Marseille for processing before being routed to the U.S. That's the so-called French connection, with distribution controlled by the mafia. The immigration of triad leaders from Hong Kong in the 90s enabled the Chinese to assume control of the networks, bypassing Marseille, which had once handled the bulk of the material. The triads established routes either through Amsterdam or directly to Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver before importing the drug to its ultimate market, the U.S. And most investigators identify the 14K triad as the primary source of the drug. In the end, though, the triad's methods may be their undoing. In the North American drug market, their dominance has been challenged by violent new Vietnamese gangs who dismiss tradition and mystique in favor of raw physical intimidation. The Vietnamese have long been considered more ruthless and aggressive than other Asian groups, a tradition that began with their first infiltration of North America during the 80s. As one former RCMP drug squad officer explained, the leaders of the early gangs came out of the aftermath of the Vietnam War. These guys were already hardened. They might have been army-trained or street criminals, but when North Vietnam took over, first they settled in refugee camps, then they had to fight and survive long enough to get to Canada or the U.S. without a penny to their names. They'd already seen death and violence on a grand scale, and they figured they were lucky to live through that experience, so they really had little to lose. In many cities, triads actually withdrew from some criminal activities rather than clash with the more violent Vietnamese, preferring to focus on Chinese businesses and individuals exclusively and leave the rest of the market to the newcomers. The future of the Chinese triad secret societies does remain cloudy. Some speculate that the rising economic power and continuing high level of corruption in China will produce a corresponding increase in triad activity there in spite of that country's policy of conducting swift executions of high-level criminals. Others suggest that triads have flourished to some degree as a result of China's historical subservience to foreign powers, and with its growing economic clout and international influence, the triads may return to their historical emphasis on cultural concerns. Whichever way the triads evolve, they'll retain the secrecy and structure built over 2,000 years since the Red Eyebrows banded together to overthrow a domineering emperor. Of all the secret societies active in the world today, the triads remain engaged in a cultural, linguistic environment that few Westerners can begin to fathom. And from the triads, it's a short step to the mafia, or La Cosa Nostra, this thing of ours. You know, nothing distinguishes the mafia from other secret societies more than omerta, the rigid code of silence. And nothing more clearly tracks the decline in the mafia's discipline and status in America, at least, than the contrasting actions of two high-level members. Louis Lepke Burkhalter, head of a notorious gang of hired killers, and the 400-pound Joseph Big Joey Massino, don of New York's once powerful banana crime family. Burkhalter died in 1944 in an electric chair. 60 years later, Massino dealt his own organization a potential death blow in a manner that would have driven the short-fused Burkhalter into a state of apoplexy. Between them, they traced the fall of one of the world's most powerful secret societies from the zenith of authority and dominance down to a band of disorganized thugs, many of whose exports would be humorous if they weren't so deadly. Omerta, like the mafia itself, was born not from the machinations of a criminal mastermind, but out of the desperate necessity of middle-class Sicilian families seeking control over their own lives. Like triads and templars, the appalling behavior of the mafia and its various progeny is actually rooted in good intentions. The most easily recognized country in any atlas of the Mediterranean region is Italy and its boot-shaped peninsula. The toe of the Italian boot ends barely 20 kilometers from the shores of Sicily, making the island appear as a distended soccer ball being eternally kicked across the sea. And the image is apt due to its strategic location. Sicily was the object of invasion, colonization, and exploitation by powerful outside interests for hundreds of years. And it proved vital to Mediterranean trade and colonization, an important port for merchants and military expeditions traveling to and from North Africa and the Middle East and Europe and the Adriatic. Following the collapse of the Roman Empire, Sicily endured a chain of invasions, each leaving an indelible mark on its people and culture. The spread of Islam brought Arab raiders to its shore in 826 AD. The Muslims proved relatively tolerant of the existing society, permitting non-Muslims to practice their own religion, or influence of Sicilian culture lies at the root of two mafia qualities maintained to this day. One was the position of women in society. Until the arrival of the Muslims, Sicilian society functioned much like others living under Judeo-Christian influence, with women playing a relatively important role in family decision-making. In comparison, Islamic law subordinated women. After their arrival, decisions within the family, within the culture, generally were made by men, an attitude that took deeper root in Sicily than in other Christian nations that experienced Islamic influence, and one that continues down to this day. The Arabs also brought a sense of internal peace and justice. Lacking a system of enforcement to deal with criminal acts, Islamic forces depending on personal responsibility to avenge crimes. These two qualities, limited rights for women and an obligation to seek vengeance for personal redress, remained embedded in Sicilian society long after the departure of the Islamic invaders. In AD 1000, a wave of invasion brought the Normans, who replaced Islamic influence with an imposed feudal system in which vassals owed their allegiance and lives to their landlord. And each lord dispensed justice in his own manner, producing a patchwork system that left native Sicilians angry and confused. Out of control of their own destiny and subject to the whims of outsiders, the Sicilians turned inward, embracing the assumption that nothing and no one was to be trusted except the immediate family. Only family provided hope for security and justice, and a man could commit no more outrageous crime than to break his loyalty to his own family. With this presumption, the seeds of the mafia were sown onto fertile soil. Now, for hundreds of years, Sicily remained a pawn of foreign powers. In 1265, Pope Clement IV, acting in his own interest, declared Charles of Anjou, brother of French King Louis IX, the new king of Sicily. Arriving with a large, powerful army and intent on totally dominating the Sicilians, Charles followed the Pope's dictates faithfully, becoming among the most arrogant and brutal of all medieval monarchs. With the passage of time, seething hatred toward Charles and his French administrators produced a fable that supposedly explains the origin of the term mafia. According to the tale, Sicilian loathing of the French was expressed in a slogan whispered among the rebellious Sicilians who would greet each other with Morte alla Francia Italia Anelia, death to the French is Italy's cry. To prevent the phrase from being overheard by French soldiers, it was shortened down to Mafia. The story is considered apocryphal at best. Most dictionaries attribute the word to Sicilian dialect, meaning bragging or manly, and in Sicily, it doesn't necessarily imply a criminal identity. Whatever its origins, though, mafia came to symbolize the secret, most distrustful nature commonly associated with the Sicilians. Charles and his army brutalized Sicilians to the point where the island nation's entire population developed into a massive bomb waiting for a detonator that arrived on Easter Sunday, 1282, in classic mafioso manner. On that day, a young Sicilian woman in Palermo on her way to Vespers was accosted and insulted by a group of French soldiers. Without warning, several outraged Sicilian men attacked the soldiers, killing them on the spot. When word of the attack spread, first to neighboring towns and eventually across the island, other Sicilian men joined the revolt, overwhelming and annihilating the French garrison in an explosive uprising that became known as Sicilian Vespers. Sicilian leaders knew it was only a matter of time before Charles gathered an army and returned to Sicily with massacre on his mind. In a strategic move, they appealed to Peter III of Aragon, a sworn enemy of Charles and possessor of extensive lands in Spain. Peter, of course, was naturally pleased to oblige, proclaiming his sovereignty over Sicily and preventing Charles from wreaking vengeance on the Sicilians as he planned. Well, with Peter's death, Sicily's fortunes were now in the hands of Spanish rulers, where they remained for some 500 years. The Spaniards, in contrast with the Muslims, who opened Sicilian life to other cultures, exerted tight control by imposing strict censorship on the country. Sicily remained isolated from the rest of the world for the next several hundred years, a period when all the rest of Western Europe was caught up in the artistic and scientific advances of the Renaissance. As a result, the intellectual and cultural eruption that changed the character of European civilization bypassed Sicily entirely. Developments in music, painting, sculpture, philosophy, agriculture, science, architecture, and other miracles of the period passed unknown to the people living literally within sight of the Italian boot, where many of these advances were taking place. The Spanish preserved the feudal system imposed by the Normans long after it had crumbled in mainland Europe. Sicilians suffered more under Spanish rule than under the Normans because the Spanish were even more discriminatory and brutal in dispensing justice. Some powerful Spanish lords living in Sicily, for example, were exempted from paying any tax at all. To fill the quota, the lords had to impose higher demands on their own vassals and peasants, increasing the inequality of Sicilian life. Sicilians who dared object to Spanish dictums risked execution by either their lord or representatives of the Spanish government. The long arm of Spanish reckoning, the dreaded Inquisition, added hideous torture to the hazard of speaking out or defying authority in any manner. Other cultures were subjected in a like manner through history. Only in Sicily, though, were injustices imposed so heavily on a people who had learned to turn inward as a means of defense and self-preservation. And only in Sicily was the population removed for so long from the positive influences of the Renaissance and the increasingly enlightened views of the Catholic Church. And only in Sicily did anything like the Mafia arise in direct response to this long litany of violence and humiliation. Well, around 1500, one aspect of contemporary European life arrived in Sicily when the island's tradesmen began forming guilds. In other words, in other countries, the guilds functioned as a means for the tradesmen to train personnel and establish standards, just as the Freemasons began in England. Sicilian trade guilds added a unique aspect to their operations when they assumed a judicial role as well, dispensing punishment to their members without any involvement from local officials who, of course, couldn't be trusted. The rise of the guilds coincided with the rise of bandit gangs, reminiscent of the legendary and most believed fictional bandits led by Robin Hood in England 500 years before. The gangs targeted Spanish lords and nobles, robbing and murdering them, and represented the only means available for most Sicilians to strike back at their oppressors. They also distributed food to starving families in the villages around Palermo. To ensure their fair share, families would choose somebody to represent them and distribute the food among brothers, sisters, and cousins. These men, many of them members of the bandit gangs, were called capodocina, shortened to capos. You know, it's interesting to note that the circle has come completely around. The Mafia is actually distributing food in Italy today. So there's really nothing new under the sun. Like Sherwood Forest Outlaws, the Sicilian bandits created their own folk heroes, including those who lauded their bravery and exploits as examples of gallantry. The most celebrated of them all, a man by the name of Saponara, was captured in prison in 1578. According to Sicilian lore, Saponara was tortured by Spanish captors in an effort to learn the names of his cohorts, but he chose to die in agony rather than betray his friends. And his bravery became a symbol for every Sicilian who believed their salvation could be achieved only through loyalty. Driven by The actions of the bandit gangs that grew steadily in strength and daring, many Spanish landowners abandoned the countryside to relocate in Palermo, Sicily's largest city. By early 1600s, most of the largest estates were being administered by Gabrielotti, managers chosen by the Spanish landowners for the prominence and respect they commanded among local citizens. The most important function of the Gabrielotti was tax collection carried out by Uomo di Fiducia, men appointed to visit personally every citizen and pocket the tax payments. The collectors, often accompanied by campieri, armed and mounted men assigned to maintain the peace and command respect. Now, to anyone familiar with the modern mafia, the Gabrielotti, Uomo di Fiducia, and campieri portray an early mafia organizational chart. Even the management technique is recognizable. From a distant, luxurious setting, the order to collect stipends from the common people would go out to a series of bosses, or capos as they were known. On instructions from the capos, low-level workers would pay personal visits to the targeted sources of money, accompanied by armed men to enforce the command. Neither Al Capone or Tony Soprano could have drawn up a more appropriate model for the system that they used to gather their own wealth. The withdrawal from the countryside of the Spanish lords and their replacement by appointed bosses served as inspiration for Sicilians to begin to assume control of their own destinies. Coinciding with the belated rise of the middle class, who sought affluence through the new role of playing a middleman, the mold to achieve wealth and power had been created and remained in place after the Spanish withdrew in the mid-19th century. Now, the Spanish departure created a vacuum of authority. For 1,000 years, Sicily had no effective governing body, and with the withdrawal of the Spanish, only one organization existed that could fill that role: the Mafia. The Italian nation builder and liberator Garibaldi arrived in 1860 to bring Sicily into the Italian kingdom. But those hundreds of years of secrecy and independence couldn't be undone overnight. In fact, as history has proven, they weren't undone at all. The Mafia continued to exert its power and influence over government institutions imposed on Sicily by Rome, and within a few years, virtually every Sicilian political office and court was infiltrated and controlled by Mafia elements. Centuries of dominance by outside powers had carved a scar across the face of Sicily that prevented most of the island's citizens from trusting any imposed authority, no matter how legitimate its power or how even-handed its approach. The law, as enforced by government, could not be trusted to deliver justice. To most Sicilians, only a vendetta was effective because all crimes were personal and all vengeance was to be meted out by the oppressed victim and his family as directed by Omerta. The Code of Omerta decreed that any man who appealed for law enforcers to right a wrong was either a fool or a coward, and any wounded or offended man who could name his assailant was beneath contempt. The classic response of a wounded man to his assailant, spoken aloud or silently, was, "If I live, I will kill you. If I die, you're forgiven." The Mafia's strength originated with and continues to be drawn from its organizational structure. Primitive in terms of other more beneficent institutions such as governments and the Catholic Church, the Mafia nevertheless managed to develop a configuration that exerted discipline and control over its members. Over time, it crafted the group into an effective power in the same manner the disorganized guerrillas are transformed into an effective fighting force by adapting the techniques of a regimented, motivated army. Ranked from the top down, the organization of Sicilian Mafia included the Capo Crimini, or Capo di Tutti Capi, superboss, boss of bosses, Capo Bastoni, the underboss, or second in command, Contabile, financial advisor, Corpo Regime, or Corpo Decimi, head of a crew consisting of 10 Sagaristas. The Sagarista are the foot soldiers who carry out the daily business of the family. In the U.S., that refers to a made member. The Picciotto, low-ranking soldiers, enforcers, or button men. And Giovanni di Honor, non-Sicilian or non-Italian associate, who actually is honored by the organization. Italians correctly maintain the Mafia's existence has created offensive stereotypes. Not every Italian is a Mafia member, of course, just as not every Chinese is a triad member, every Muslim a supporter of Al-Qaeda. But even the most vociferous Italian patriot has to agree the mafia is not unique among Italian secret societies bent on crime and violence. While criminal gangs exist in virtually every large urban center the world over, the Italian breed remains distinctive in its fixed structure and reliance on violence as a means of achieving its goals. Nor does the mafia represent the only Italian secret criminal society. In reality, at least three other extensive organizations with Italian roots remain active, their existence inspired, if not nurtured, by the mafia. Of these, the 'Ndrangheta is most closely associated with the mafia, both geographically and historically. Operating in the rugged rural regions of Calabria, the northernmost part of the Italian boot, the 'Ndrangheta resulted from the Italian government's ill-fated efforts to break up the mafia by banishing its most violent and powerful leaders and their families from Sicily in the 1860s. Now, frankly, this was a foolish move. The family simply relocated on the mainland directly across the straits from Messina, where in remote Calabrian villages they formed a secret society that differed from the mafia in two distinct ways. It became even more secretive and even more violent. A high-ranking Italian government official recently described the 'Ndrangheta as the most powerful and dangerous criminal organization in Italy because of its viciousness. The organization derives its name from the Greek word 'ndrangheses, meaning a noble and courageous man worthy of respect. Reflecting its origins, these violent families banished from ancestral Sicilian homes, the 'Ndrangheta is organized exclusively along family lines, which produces a profound difference between it and the Sicilian mafia. The Sicilians are bound by oaths, the 'Ndrangheta by blood. In addition, the 'Ndrangheta reportedly uses women in active roles from time to time, although its structures remain clearly male-dominated. Unlike the classic pyramid structure of the mafia, the 'Ndrangheta is organized on a horizontal basis and divided into clearly defined family segments, or 'Ndrangheta. No overlap occurs between the activities or geographic regions of two neighboring families. Each has full control within its own territory and a monopoly on all the activity there. The combination of tight structure and family blood provides the 'Ndrangheta with an enormous ability to maintain both secrecy and loyalty, consolidated through carefully arranged marriages between the 'Ndrangheta. Nothing in Sicilian and Calabrian culture is more sacrosanct than family, and where linkages exist through marriage, it would be an act of serious dishonor for one family to perform any act that would threaten the security of a related family. As one Sicilian parish priest explained, there is strength in the sacred and impregnable structure of the family, the only secure place. Only blood does not betray, and that's their basic philosophy. Compared with the 'Ndrangheta, the mafia appears almost lax and sloppy in its internal discipline. Sons of mafia members may choose to follow their fathers into the organization or not. Sons of the 'Ndrangheta have no choice. Become a member of the criminal families, their diritto di sangue, right of blood, assigned at birth. While being groomed for their life's work, a process that begins shortly after puberty, male children are Giovanni di Honor, or Boys of Honor. At maturity, they become Picciotto di Honor. Soldiers expected to carry out orders from their superiors without question and without fail. The best of these are chosen as camorrista, in charge of groups of Picciottos. When they've risen to the level of Santista, they can finally claim a fixed share of the spoils instead of the small stipend paid to the lower ranks. Through his exceptional work and after solemnly swearing his dedication on the Bible, a Santista may be promoted to the level of Vigilista, or perhaps later to join the Quintino, five privileged sub-bosses with direct linkage to the Capo Bastone, the highest power within the 'Ndrangheta family. Members of the Quintino are permitted to identify themselves with a tattoo of a five-pointed star. Tight secrecy, together with a reputation for extreme violence, has been their strength in maintaining its power and expanding its influence. Unlike the mafia, no one can confidently estimate the size and global extent of its criminal activities, though in 2004, the Italian government did suggest the 'Ndrangheta consisted of 155 family clans and a total membership of a little over 6,000. Either as a result of honest ignorance, the organization's extreme secrecy, or in an effort to downplay the group's power, some observers have suggested the group is harmless to non-Italians, and Italians themselves are quick to endorse this perception. Promoting the region as a holiday destination, the Calabrian Tourist Office admits you'll find no Florences or Venices in Calabria. Instead, in an act of remarkable candor, the tourist office notes Calabrian roads can be brutal and occasionally obstructed by police roadblocks. The office that organizes tours of Calabria promises we have avoided planning itineraries in certain inland areas, which are virtual strongholds of the Ndrangheta, the local mafia whose main source of revenue is kidnapping their children of wealthy northern industrialists and hiding them in inaccessible caves in the Aspromonte until astronomical ransoms are paid for their release. Should be said, tourists are never the object of this type of crime, and indeed, if you travel to Calabria, you'll probably never encounter any of these dangers. Probably. Now, that's reassuring. Of course, you may also enter a Calabrian village and encounter a sight similar to that witnessed by the citizens of Taranova, a town not far from Reggio di Calabria, where local Nandrina first beheaded a counselor who opposed the control of the region and used his severed head for target practice in the town square. Now, this wasn't a medieval-era act, or even an event that took place 100 years ago. It occurred in 1995. In the 1860s, a traveler to Naples arriving by sea noticed that moments after he handed his boatman the fare, the man appeared at the boatman's side, muttered a word, and got a portion of the traveler's payment before vanishing into the shadows. Same traveler, stepping from the carriage that brought him to his hotel that day, observed a similar incident. A man appeared at the driver's side, inspected the fare before claiming a portion of it. Reaching the door to his hotel room, the traveler paused to watch the porter, who he had just tipped for carrying his luggage to the room, stop to hand part of his gratuity to another man, as furtive and silent as the first two. That evening, a tourist attended the opera to find men of a similar dress and demeanor carefully counting the money that changed hands from painter to ticket seller. When the tourist described those events to an Italian acquaintance the next day, anticipating the explanation, a friend closed his eyes, shook his head slightly, and said, Camorra. Now, that word's origins may lie in the Spanish term for dispute, although today it's simply translated as gang. It sprang up from a Neapolitan strain of the same breed of secret societies, the Mafia and the Ndrangheta. And like these two criminal branches, Camorra was spawned not within blood-related families, but from prison gangs who, released from custody, carried their talent for organization and intimidation to the streets. Camorra established itself in and around Naples as a paternal organization, dedicated to providing assurance to the citizens and businesses of Naples that they would not be harassed by anybody except, of course, Camorra members in the event that its payments were not received. Mafia families in the U.S. adapted this policy in the 20s when it became known as the Protection Racket. Members are also ready to settle disputes and offer assistance to poorer families or victims of accidents and disease. The organization proved as vicious in handling its own members as in intimidating the public, whose income it siphoned. Admission into the order required that newcomers commit a major crime to prove their courage and dedication. The very act of being asked to qualify Camorra membership represented a crisis because any man who refused the opportunity to join the group by committing the crime risked signing his own death warrant if his killing became the task assigned to a more courageous and less scrupulous candidate. Kind of a catch-22, I guess you could say. Whether they considered it futile to battle the Camorristi or fulfill its own Machiavellian strategies, Neapolitan government officials not only tolerated the group, but reportedly employed it for the government's own ends. For years, Neapolitan jails and prisons were administered and disciplined by the Camorra, and the organization reportedly worked with local police to track down and punish criminal acts carried out by anyone who was not a Camorristi. The group structure reflects the mafias for the most part, with a capo di Camorra collecting and distributing payments to several smaller groups made up of second-tier leaders and their soldiers. Unlike the mafia, though, it appears to shun mystical initiations and procedures. Like other secret organizations engaged in criminal activity, the fortunes of the Camorra ebb and flow. From time to time, crusading politicians claim it's been laid to rest and so weakened that it's no longer a serious factor. Recent assessments suggest the Camorra consists of over 100 different clans with about 7,000 members. Though much of the 20th century, the Camorra's principal source of income was cigarette smuggling throughout Italy and neighboring countries, performed with such efficiency that Camorra combined forces with the Mafia to handle the organization's European drug distribution, which was an immensely profitable move, I might add. This led to a series of territorial battles within the Camorra, resulting in an estimated 400 violent deaths and driving as many as 200 Camorra members to the U.S., where they quickly set up gangs to deal in money laundering, extortion, robbery, blackmail, kidnapping, and counterfeiting. Despite that flurry of expansion, Camorra remains primarily a Naples-based operation, lacking the mystique and historical fascination of the Mafia. Another Mafia-oriented group germinated in southern Italy was in Puglia, the peninsula that forms the heel of the boot of Italy. Sacra Corona Unita, or United Sacred Crown, began like the Camorra with prison gangs who gathered in remote regions where they could be free from surveillance by central authorities. Headquarters in the port city of Brindisi, the Sacra Corona earned much of its income by smuggling travelers to and from Croatia, Albania, and other countries across the Adriatic. It's never achieved the scale of operations of the Mafia or the Camorra, either in Italy or in the U.S. Had the Mafia remained in Italy, it could hardly have registered on any books other than those dealing exclusively with criminal organizations. Its arrival in the U.S. on the cusp of the 20th century and its metamorphosis into a purely American strain of secret society vaulted it into public consciousness and secured it a place in popular culture. Everybody in the U.S. knows Mafia. Few, though, fully understand its structure, operations, and influence. For example, the term Mafia is not entirely correct when referring to the U.S. counterparts, whose members refer to their organization as Cosa Nostra, this thing of ours. And while Omerta and other tools to ensure secrecy remain in place, the American branch has attempted to structure itself as a reflection of U.S. business principles rather than an extension of mystical medieval vows. In the Americas, at least, the perceived value of Wall Street carry more authority than thousand-year-old rituals of Sicily. The first recorded incident of Mafia-based crime occurred in New Orleans in 1891 when a Sicilian crime family murdered the local chief of police who had been pressuring them with arrest and harassment. Family leaders were tried for murder, but thanks to some witnesses being bribed and others being threatened with death, they were all acquitted. Before they could be released, though, an angry lynch mob shouting anti-Italian slogans stormed the jailhouse, drugged the culprits into the street, and shot or hung 16 of them. A lesson may have been learned. While New Orleans has one of the highest crime rates of any city of its size in the country, the influence of the Cosa Nostra has never reached the level of other communities, notwithstanding Oliver Stone's claims in his movies JFK. While the Cosa Nostra's roots were well established by the end of World War I, two events, one in Italy and the other in the U.S., propelled the organization into a major force. The introduction of Prohibition in 1919 created a low-cost, high-demand, high-profit opportunity for criminals, especially those operating within an organization that could manufacture, import, and distribute its products under the noses or with the collaboration of law enforcement. And no other criminal activity promised such enormous profits. Meanwhile, the dictator Benito Mussolini was rising to power in Italy with the promise of eradicating crime and ensuring the trains ran on time, among other pledges. And he succeeded at both. His fascist administration was the only one brutal enough to threaten Mafia control, and soon many Mafia families were emigrating across the Atlantic, where they joined families reaping massive amounts of money from illegal alcohol. Now, northern cities like New York, Chicago, Cleveland, and Detroit are much more closely identified with Cosa Nostra activities, but more than two dozen communities, as bucolic in nature, Des Moines, Iowa, and San Jose, California, also became operational centers. The repeal of Prohibition in 1933 left an intact organization that turned its attention to other illegal means of making a profit. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow night at 6 o'clock Mountain, 8 o'clock Eastern. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a great evening.